Okay, it's time to start, I think. So for those of you in the tape room, you can start recording. Welcome to what is the final of five sessions on ethics and energy. How many of you have heard at least one of the others? Okay, we'll do a little reviewing as we go. For those of you who hadn't been here, Kevin and I this week have been trying to sort of lay out a concept that that we have pitched as the ethics of energy. What we mean by that is twofold. In an ethical framework, we're trying to create a place and a few frameworks to allow civil discourse between folks from different disciplinary backgrounds and perhaps different perspectives into a subject that is pretty complex. Energy is a very broad term. It can mean a lot of things to a scientist. It can mean a lot of things to to someone in the humanities. The way that we've chosen to look at energy is what we think is in sort of the broadest context that we can think of, and that is energy as a fungible material. Kevin says we use fungible because it's got fun in it, but fungible meaning changeable. So both from a use standpoint and from a supply standpoint. I'll give you a couple examples. If you think about energy, many different things pop to mind. Some people will think about fire, something people will think about gasoline, something people will think about electricity. But we want you to include in your scope of energy definitions food, water, clean air, because clean air is in dynamic tension with many of the ways that we create energy. And so when Kevin and I are talking about energy use, we are not simply focusing down on the number of gallons of gasoline we use or the amount of electricity we use. We're talking about food. We're talking about water. Because guess what? The more energy that we put in our car, the less that's left over for our food and our water. So it really is changeable. And for those of you who've heard some of the other sessions, we've spent a fair amount of time trying to define that, talk about it, give examples, and if you're interested in the notion, perhaps you can listen to these on tape. Just as the uses of energy are changeable, fungible, the supply chain coming in is as well. And so we think about the energy supply system being renewable sources, sun, wind, waves. These are all renewable things that are not extractive, that that we are freely given. We have not talked a lot about the technologies of renewable energies because we sort of stipulate that these have to be part of our energy for the future. What we've tried to do is focus on sort of our current use of energy and our past use of energy, which is wood 200 years ago, coal, petroleum, natural gas, hydroelectric power, nuclear power. All these things are from a chemistry perspective, from a natural science perspective, pretty fungible. It's simple, for instance, to take coal and turn it into gasoline. If you're a chemist, it's not that hard. Natural gas and gasoline are really quite interchangeable. We have found out recently that food, biomass, and fuel for our cars are quite interchangeable. And so just as the choices that we use to consume energy are variable, the choices that we use to use energy are variable. Notice that hydrogen wasn't in my list, and the reason for that, again, we did a session on it. Hydrogen really isn't an energy source. Hydrogen is a very convenient way to store energy, but we have to make the hydrogen. And that energy needs to come from one of the other sources that we've talked about. One of a framework that we have used for this to try and enable the discussion is to define energy even broader than what I've talked about. What I've been talking about here are natural sources of energy. The way a natural scientist would think about energy, the ability to do work. But there's also another form of energy that we need to honor, and that's this notion of social energy. This capacity to do social work, the energy that a society uses to make a decision or enable a policy, is another form, is another investment. Both of these need to be thought of when we start making ethical decisions around energy. So what we've got here is what we call a sustainability triangle. So the idea here is that if we're looking for a solution about something like energy use, what we need to do is think of three different feed lines going in terms of supporting elements of this decision. There's an economic piece. What are the economic constraints that we choose in many times to put around a particular solution? What's the technology? What's the science? What is the capability of a particular source of energy? And also, where the community sits. This is social acceptance. This is tax policy. This is the people we elect. The community has a big voice in a sustainable solution. So three things to keep in dynamic balance: what's possible, the broad economic drivers around it, and the community driving forces and support. The reason we've got three triangles here is that the other frame here is a scale argument. The two scales are time and space. You can't pick an environmental issue and solve it generically. You have to decide who you are talking about, where you're talking about, and what the time frame. So what we've got here is an inner sphere that might be a personal or community space. Solving the long-term energy demands for Holden Village is a completely different question than solving the long-term energy demands for the planet. Different set of technical inputs, different economic constraints, different community issues there. And so part of the question is, are we local? Maybe a middle circle might be national. We've talked a lot this week about whether energy independence at a national level should be one of these driving forces for maximizing our use of energy. Then obviously a global outer ring. So this is all just by the way of kind of reminding us where we've been. For those of you who have been around or are interested in this sort of more resources in this broader debate, if you're looking at technical and economic arguments around energy supply, energy use, and its impact at a global level, a great resource on this side of the triangle is the Lester Brown book that is in the bookstore, Plan B 3.0. Very readable, very modular. You can read what he's got to say about oil, about water, about how to feed 8 billion people. It's a great resource on this side. On this side, focusing on community and economic issues, the more social side, what we've got is Earth Ethics by Larry Rasmussen, which you also find. At a sort of person on the ground level, techniques that you can use individually or at a congregational level for those of you who belong to faith communities. We'll do a shameless pitch at this point for Earth Ministry. Both Kevin and I are on the board of Earth Ministry, so there's resources there as well. So so technical, economic, social, economic, and sort of faith community structural resources for you. Okay, so let's move into. We've done about 10 minutes of review here. Let's talk about what we want to do today. What we want to do today is try and somehow bring these arguments home, integrate them, synthesize them a little bit, and talk about the so what. So what? What does this mean for us? What are some questions that that we might ask ourselves as we walk away from this process? A place that I think is really interesting. Kevin, when he was talking about a frame for energy consumption in sort of the ethical realm, described the U.S. as a entity that consumes energy at the global level. So the scope of the consumption of what we do as a nation is global. But if you look at the sort of moral responsibility that we often talk about at Energy, most of the discussion is not global. Most of the discussion is national, and indeed, actually, some of it's very local, less than national. And so, one sort of early warning test about energy and ethics, or ethics in anything, is make sure your scales match. If you've got a mismatch in the scales, that's an early warning sign that perhaps we need to think a little bigger on the ethical side, or maybe a little smaller on the consumption side. And so I want to move to this sort of, we have not talked much over the course of the week about conservation, using less energy. All of our discussions have been around the sort of consequences and ethics around potential new large energy sources. We talked about hydrogen, we talked about biofuels, we talked about nuclear power. But there really is the obvious other kind of flip side of this argument is how much energy do we consume? We have a finite amount of natural energy in the world. We have a constrained amount of fossil fuels. Even if we go nuclear, we have a constrained amount of uranium. We have certainly constrained amounts of biomass available to us, constrained by land, constrained by water, constrained by fertilizer or fossil fuels. So there's a constraint on natural energy. There's also constraints around social energy. It's not physically defined and constrained like we have with natural energy, but it's certainly not infinite. And it also can work in positive ways and negative ways. So we have a finite capacity for energy. It's a fundamental notion that if we move to the fact that energy is finite, then the amount of energy that each of us uses is going to depend on how many of us there are, if we're sitting out here. Right? Energy is food. Energy is water. So the more energy that is consumed in the U.S., the less energy that we have for other places. This is something that social scientists argue about and call carrying capacity. How many people can we fit on the planet? Some people think it's 6 billion. Some people think it's 25 billion. And in our opinion, the answer to that question is how much energy does each individual consume? So conservation, limiting a resource utilization is obviously part of the issue. And a huge portion of this notion that we hope to kind of carry away from at the end of this hour is that for me, when I talk about social, when I talk about carrying capacity of the planet, when I lecture to freshmen at PLU where I teach on, you know, how many people can the planet hold, it's an interesting sort of, for many Americans, unfortunately, it's an interesting sort of abstract discussion. What are the variables? People use It's, you know, distribution of food and water. It's kind of a, it's a nice little, you know, puzzle. Oftentimes, our U.S.-centric view is we believe that there's going to be some magic bullets out there that are going to provide cheap, clean energy in an abundant way, so we don't have to worry about this future carrying capacity notion. One of the things that I think it's important to kind of leave you with as a starting point for this discussion is that this is not an abstract thing. We now have a starting emerging national debate on the emerging food crisis in the world. You know, the fact that we've got, we have just an unbelievable, unprecedented rise in food prices, an unprecedented drop in the amount of U.S. aid to foreign countries because they are budgeted in dollars and those dollars are not translated to as much food anymore. This is social justice today. So what I don't believe, and Kevin agrees with, is that we can't make this an abstract ethical notion. This is not a problem for 5 years from now. Not a problem for 20 years from now. This is a problem today. We need to try and have a discussion about what we're going to do today. Is that fair?
Yeah. Sounds fair.
All right. Can you lead that discussion?
No, but I can keep talking for a while. Right. So the title that we set for today is Should We Have All We Want? And we want to talk about that today because we hope we've built up enough language that we have the tools to talk about that. And one of the linguistic tools is this scale piece that helps us think about who's the we in that question. Because if the we in that question is a family in sub-Saharan Africa living in drought conditions, that the energy they want is the energy to get enough water to stay at a basic level of health and sanitation, then the answer is yes. That we should have all that we want. But if the we that we're talking about includes me and it's wanting to wash my car in the middle of the summer when there isn't much rain coming down, then it's a really different question. And as Brian says, this is an issue of social justice because people are in different places in this world. And so, who do we mean when we say, should we have all we want? We have a couple different answers to that question. The we that I want to talk most about is the we that I feel a part of, which is relatively comfortable, white, U.S. citizen. And if we ask, should relatively comfortable white U.S. citizens have all we want when it comes to energy? I think the answer right now is probably no. And that's because we don't want correctly. Brian said that we're addicted to energy a couple days ago, and I think this is just a crucial point. Our relationship to energy, our relationship to the energy we can find to consume is incredibly unhealthy. Just to prove I did study Christian ethics, I will say Thomas Aquinas would say our wants are disordered. We don't want the right thing. Thomas Aquinas would say, should we have what we want? Yes, but only given that what we want is what we should want. And we don't want what we should want because we're an addict looking for our next fix. And I mentioned on the first day, the first time Brian told me, we can change coal into oil, no problem. Coal into gasoline, no problem. There was a part of me that said, whew, I'm going to be able to keep driving my car. That's an addict talking. Because what I want is to keep getting this substance that I really, really like. And I want more and more of it. And anybody who gives me the sense that they can give it to me becomes my new best friend. And I'll do whatever they ask. That's addiction. And that means our wants are unordered, our wants are unhealthy. So, those of us who are addicted, those of us who are prosperous, I think should not have all we now want. We are called to sacrifice. I want to talk about this in the context of the Christian tradition specifically. Let me just, a bigger point, if you're interested in thinking in larger terms, in other terms about how the Christian tradition can think about energy, can think about environmental issues, can think about how to want less, I really do recommend Larry's book, Earth, Community, Earth Ethics. He's done a lot of thinking about what resources do Christians have available within our traditions. And one of the things he talks about a little that I want to expand on is we have traditions of sacrifice. We have traditions of giving things up. We have to be really careful. This privileged we, has to be really careful when we talk about sacrifice. Because, Alan mentioned this a couple days ago in his Bible study, we have a really bad habit of saying, Christianity calls for sacrifice, let's start with you. We have a really bad habit of asking other people to sacrifice for our Christian principles and not thinking about what we should sacrifice. We have a really bad habit of saying that we are saved not because Christ was among us, not because Christ is risen, but because Christ was sacrificed, as if sacrifice is good for its own sake. That is not what I want to say here. I also really don't want to say that we need to tell poor people to sacrifice. We need to tell suffering people to sacrifice. What I want to say is people like me, people who are addicted to energy and living quite comfortably right now, need to sacrifice. It's never the job, according to the Christian gospel, of the rich to tell the poor how to live. The opposite is true. So I'm not trying to tell other people to sacrifice. I'm trying to try and tell this we that I'm a part of to sacrifice. And I'm saying we have some traditions in Christian faith for sacrifice. We have traditions of fasting. We have traditions of Sabbath. And Sabbath and fasting aren't particularly in vogue right now because they sound like giving something up. And when you tell an addict to give something up and they can get away from you, they do. But fasting and Sabbath really do mean something and really can contribute something at this time in our life as a culture, as a church. The Sabbath is about taking joy in certain aspects of life by sort of letting other aspects of life be quiet. And I think we need to think about that in terms of energy consumption. What would it be like to take a Sabbath from petroleum use? Fasting is also about taking joy in something by recognizing its absence. I have a dear friend that I grew up with who's Jewish. And it used to be on Yom Kippur, on the Day of Atonement, when we were kids, he would watch cooking shows on PBS. Because he said it focused his attention on food. And he really thought that food looked delicious. Because he couldn't eat. He had this new awareness of food. Today, my friend spends Yom Kippur with his daughter working at local food banks or farms. Again, because he thinks this is a day to focus on food. This is a day to pay attention to food. When I have had a long day and go to a drive-thru and cram oil in my mouth from the drive-thru, I'm doing the opposite. I'm paying absolutely no attention to the food I'm eating. So fasting is a way to pay attention. Sabbath is a way to pay attention. These are traditions we should be taking advantage of. These are all also traditions, incidentally, that would reduce our consumption a little bit. Imagine if every Lutheran took the Sabbath off from petroleum use. It wouldn't solve any problems, but it would make a noticeable dent in the petroleum use of this nation. So it makes us aware of something. It can show us the joy we should take in food, in family, in fellowship. And it can also limit our consumption. So I throw these things out. These are things we could do. These are things I could do. These are things I've tried. But then we need to ask. These Christian strategies for conservation, other strategies for conservation, what scale are they working at? Now, every Lutheran in the country, that's smaller than the national scale, a little bigger than the Holden Village scale. I hope every Lutheran in the country isn't here right now, because I hope there's more. They'd be welcome. So that's somewhere in this middle area. It's still not that big. And if the problem is a global problem, if our consumption is global, then we probably need to think about conservation strategies that are bigger than a fast for one day a week, a Sabbath for one day a week. So these scales are not just scales of the problem, they're not just scales of our consumption, they're not even just scales of our moral attention, they're also scales of conservation. What does it mean to conserve on a local level, a national level, a global level? A local level is pretty much what I've been talking about. Lifestyle changes I can decide to make. And there is no shortage of suggestions for lifestyle decisions we can make to reduce our consumption of energy. It is not hard to find a book that will offer you 100 things you can do to save the planet. Almost all of those things you won't really notice having done. It won't be a big change in your life. Get some cloth grocery bags, keep them around so you don't have to get plastic grocery bags when you go to a grocery store. Good thing to do, but it's small scale. Bigger scale would be systemic changes. We change our agricultural subsidy policies. We change the subsidies we give oil companies, petroleum companies to explore for new resources. Those would be systemic changes, those would be much bigger. But then there's even bigger changes. There's global changes we can imagine, which would be revolutionary. We decide, as I suggested yesterday, that we shouldn't get our energy by consuming matter. We should only get our energy when it's available around us, from the sun, from the wind, from the tides. We decide not to consume matter to get energy. That's as big scale a change as I can imagine in our energy system. There's trade-offs between these. If I focus all my attention on getting everyone I know to commit to this petition that we should not get our energy from burning matter, if I focus all my attention on there, I'm probably still using plastic grocery bags and driving along. On the other hand, if I decide I will not consume any petroleum myself, I refuse, I will be pure, I will not be part of this oil economy, it's going to be really hard to get the message out to other people, to get them to join me in my crusade.
You'd also have to take your shoes off.
I'd also have to take my shoes off. I would be standing on holy ground, and I would happily take my shoes off. So we have to make some decisions about where we put our personal, our social energy. So quick example of this, and then we'll start, we'll say some more things. Quick example of this is nuclear power, which we talked about yesterday. Nationally, we have about the same percentage as globally. We get about 20% of our electricity from nuclear fission. Brian and I agreed yesterday that we should stop doing that. We agreed yesterday that, in particular, the waste produced by that process is a real bad thing. And we should do what we can to stop producing more as soon as we can. We disagreed about how soon that might be, but we agreed we should stop. Really important point Brian made is, if tomorrow I could snap my fingers and the nuclear power plants would all be shut down and nothing else changed, then what would we do? We'd build a whole bunch more coal-fired power plants. So to say, let's stop using nuclear power isn't big enough. If nuclear power, even if nuclear power is our only concern, we have to say, let's use 20% less electricity. Let's find a way. Conserve. Become more efficient. That's the only way to talk about ceasing our use of nuclear power. Ceasing our use of nuclear power and trusting that there's just more energy out there we'll find and there'll be no problem, that's what we've been calling a magic bullet, and we don't trust magic bullets. We would welcome them, but we don't trust in them, and we're certainly not going to plan for them. So, if I want us to stop using nuclear power, that's not something that can happen here. I can certainly consume less energy, and I should, because I'm addicted to it and I overconsume it. But me consuming less energy is not going to end our nuclear power use. Nationally, we could end it. We could pass a law tomorrow and close down all the nuclear power plants. We could certainly decide not to commission any new nuclear power plants. We haven't in a couple decades, but it's now on the table that we might. We could decide not to. But another really crucial point Brian made yesterday is, even if we stop, we have two really big problems. First, lots of the rest of the world has nuclear power plants, and if we stop, there's nothing saying they're going to stop. And second, even if we stop tomorrow, we have all the nuclear waste we've already produced by producing electricity and by building nuclear bombs, which we are still building. Those are enormous problems. Those are global problems. So if we're worried about nuclear, we have to be thinking globally. But we can't just think globally, because those systems are really hard to change. The last thing, the way this nuclear problem is so complicated, is Brian and I were having a civil discussion about whether we should try and stop using nuclear now or in 50 years. Either way, we want to do it fast. We want an enormous global change really quickly. We want a sweeping, large-scale change on a really short time scale. And that makes it even harder, because we're not talking about educating the next generation so that they won't like nuclear power. We're talking about something quicker than that. And social change that has to happen that fast is really hard. And when it's really big, it's even harder. So this is to give a sense of the scope, the complexity of how we understand this problem. And again, we promise we are building to a discussion of what do we actually do about this. But what I want to say at this point is, we can't have all we want if our want comes from an addiction. And in order to think intelligently about that, we have to understand the global level of what it is we're facing and how hard it is to work globally, to think globally, to act globally. I want Brian to talk a little bit more about sort of how something might change, and then we'll start getting into this discussion in 50 minutes or something.
Yeah, I don't have 15 minutes of comments, but where I want to go is this responses to this issue. How, you know, if we have now had 32 minutes of what I, in my darker modes, would call naval contemplation. It's important. One must contemplate one's navel in order to understand where we're going. But what do we do? I think we can, as reasonable people, understand that there's probably three pieces. One is this is just sort of a basic awareness education piece, right? All change has to come from a sort of base understanding. These are reasonably complex technical issues. They're incredibly complex economic issues, and there may be even more complex community issues. I think that nuclear power in the U.S. will never happen again, and I don't think it's a technical problem. I don't think it's an economic problem. I think it's a social energy problem that sits right down here in this corner, and that's every bit as real an issue as the other two. So education is part of it, and we have been here, I've been up here for 2 weeks now. This is the 10th sort of environmental-related discussion that I've been a part of. We've got, this is not a snapshot byproduct of the U.S. as a whole. People who come to the mountains at the end of the long boat ride, a beautiful place, and come inside to listen to a lecture about chemistry. That's not the rank and file, right? But even the folks who attended these lectures over the last couple of weeks, some of them have learned a bit as we've talked about
the notion of biofuels and hydrogen and all these other things. So these require not a, you don't need to be a technical expert, but you need to have thought about them a little bit. So education is a piece. In my experience, a much bigger thing are the next two issues. Somewhere along the line, people have to move from a personal level to a policy level. Personal changes are incredibly important. You know, we have to say paper or plastic? No. We have to increase our gas mileage. We have to eat lower on the food chain. We have to somehow drop these consumptions. But one bad policy decision wipes out about a zillion compact fluorescent light bulbs. Policy is the place that we change these outer triangles. We have talked a lot in the village. Alan has actually kind of led the discussion over the last couple of weeks about this being a wonderful synergistic analogy in a faith journey. Understanding how how you understand a principle, you personalize it, then you move to a sort of, you move into the policy realm. What are your actions going to be? Most Americans are stuck here. We're stuck. How do we make that stuck? And I think that part of the way that we need to make that step is be committed to this notion of agency, of the fact that we elect a president. We elect our leaders. The policies of our community, our nation, are policies that we have to own up to. They're our policies. It doesn't get any harder, doesn't get any simpler, but until we take responsibility for the actions that we are committed to at a country level, there is no hope for change at the global level. I think that's a hard thing for us to accept. But let's look a little bit. Let me just work a couple examples. One example of why I think that is just, it is critical now. It is going to become unimaginably critical, maybe in the next 5 years. And this is this notion of energy as food. So let me kind of frame where we're going with the discussion. And this is this issue of how do we as individuals in a community of faith or a congregation or a church or a spiritual community, how do we reconcile our step to policy with the capitalist system? It's a hard question. Let me tell you why we think that maybe it's going to become a harder question. We all know that the capitalist process has been remarkably productive. We measure productivity. I managed for many years in a Fortune 100. Productivity on Wall Street is dollars of sales per employee. If we think about energy, it's dollars of sales per energy unit, meaning dollars per BTU. So when we have an economy that's primed to think of productivity as growth or productivity as dollars per unit. Since the beginning of the petroleum age, 1940s, 1950s, up until about 20 years ago, a bushel of wheat and a barrel of oil were about the same price. 1973, they were both about $3. From 1950 to mid-70s, they're about the same. Now, I've been in the village for a couple weeks, so I don't know what a barrel of oil is worth right now. When I came up, it was $144. And a bushel of wheat at that point in time, the wheat futures were, I think, around $7. So we have gone from a market, and I'm using the word market
in its truest sense. We have an economy that is geared to sell things into a market in a way that encourages growth. Growth is good. And we want to grow dollars, and we want to grow productivity. We want to encourage growth, and we want to sell at the highest price. This is what our economy is built on. So now I am reasonably proficient Wall Street venture capitalist. I see we have had this. There has been no net benefit to change food to oil. There, and we're not only talking biofuels here. Biofuels is a direct transformation. We literally are taking food and putting it into our cars. But remember, it's fungible. Right? The energy is so configurable that we can change it to food, or we can change it to clean water. We can change it to chemicals. We can change it to transportation sector. So we've had no macroeconomic reason to worry about competition between food and energy. Now we do. How many of you in your 401ks would not like a 20-time growth in profit? The only thing that we need to do right now to exploit that is we need to take some energy we're using in the food sector, move it into the broader energy sector. We have a 20-time return on investment. So this is a market force that is rapidly emerging. I mean, the changes that we've seen in commodity oil markets in the last 2 years are astonishing. The price of palm, the price of soy, the price of canola oil in the last 3 years have nearly tripled. And it's silly to think that today this is an issue. And I also think it's silly to think it's not going to get worse. So we've got an economic system that is built to increase consumption. It's built to increase profitability. And we now have a new twist. Food is much less valuable than energy. So what's the consequence there? We're gonna let's take a question. But
I have a question. I just was, I was starting to follow you when you were talking about the efficacy pit, mm-hmm. bit and what we need to do, and I guess I'm wondering, what are we talking about? Are we talking about what the church's response should be this, or what our individual response should be? I can tell that you're getting on the political bench, which I think is where we need to be going, and we need to be changing and help changing policy. And I'd really like to hear what people are thinking about that.
If you can hold that question for about 3 more minutes, and if we don't answer it in 3 or 4 minutes, ask it again. It's a great question.
Well, she means opening up a discussion.
We're almost there. We're almost to the discussion. Okay.
So the question we want to ask is exactly this. I think I'm hearing you right, which is how should the church relate to capitalism? How should Christians relate to capitalism? I wanna suggest that we have 2 options. And first, I wanna suggest that we don't have 2 other options. One option I don't think we have is ignore it. Not our issue. Christianity is about going to church and praying and hoping I get to heaven. I don't think that's right. I think Christianity has something to do with Jesus saying that whatever you did to the widow, to the orphan, to the poor, you did unto me. And that means that it matters what condition people are in, whether people are eating, whether people are safe. And that means that we have to be invested in our economic political structures. So I don't think we can say we just ignore it. I also don't think we can say we're gung-ho, we're all for it. Because again, if Christianity is about what's happening to the least among us, then it's about the people making $300 a year who can't afford to live in a world where food costs as much as oil. And so I don't think we can say that Christianity just rubber stamps capitalism and says, A-OK by us. That doesn't mean capitalism hasn't done phenomenal things, hasn't increased productivity and efficiency by lots of measures in amazing ways. But I don't think Christianity can say, that's it, we're all for it, go team. I think Christianity has two options. Brian and I think Christianity has two options. Christians have two options. One is to say, since we care about those who have been mistreated, since we care about the oppressed, we take care of the oppressed. These people are ignored, are left behind by capitalist structures that favor growth, that favor prosperity. And what we Christians do is we look after them. Capitalism is going to leave them behind, so we're going to take care of them. That's one option, and I think it's a very real option.
That's not what we're doing today.
But it's not what we're doing today. We're not doing that right now. That's not what we're talking about. We are talking about it, but we're not doing it. We are not taking care of the people left behind by capitalism. The other option is we say no to capitalism. Christians say, this is not a system we can approve. This is not a system that sounds like our gospel. And so we want it to go away. And we do what we can to make it go away. Brian and I, in our discussions, we think those are the two defensible things Christians might think about doing in relationship to capitalism. We also think that Christians, broadly speaking, the big we Christians, are not doing either. We're doing one of the other two. We're either saying, I don't have to worry about it, I'm a Christian, I don't think about politics and economics, or we're saying, that's a pretty good system, I'm all for it. We don't think the current options are good. Those are the two options we think make sense. And so our question to you is, which of those options makes sense, or how would you argue that we have a different option? Which I think is a way to get to your question.
Yeah.
And that's the question.
I'm pretty. I'm ready to do. And I really want to do, and I want to see other Christians do it. And so that's where I'm at. I'm not sure. Yeah, I know.
What are you ready to do?
Do what? Yeah.
I think we need to get out and start. What I have personally started doing is working with my representative, going to the state level government and talking to my representatives and saying how I feel about what's going on with the environment, what's going on.
Where are you from?
I'm from Yakima.
Okay.
I'm trying to live what I believe. And I think it's getting to be too late. But we need to be all on board and start doing something about this. And I'm beyond the capitalism thing. So it's just, and I think probably most of the people in this room are that way. I think it's just how do we get the rest of the world on board?
I'm curious.
I personally disagree with the notion that capitalism creates or propagates oppression.
Mm-hmm.
I vehemently disagree with that, and I think there are plenty of examples where capitalism has produced innovation that is like cheaper food and communications that have helped medicines that have helped people throughout the world. However, what I hear you saying is kind of to answer some of what we can act on, is kind of identifying the policies that are most critical that our government is doing that actively kind of screw up the economic landscape, supporting ethanol, corn-based ethanol,
mm-hmm.
which is directly creating the food energy competition. And and so my question for you is specifically, which policies would you suggest we lobby our congressmen to change?
Well, yeah, I want to follow up on what you just said because I agree with you that I think the capitalist system actually works pretty well for a number of reasons you just said. But when we start setting policy, when we lobby our congressmen to set policy, Congress, in their brilliance, screws up policy. When they set more policy about stuff, it makes more problems, whether it's corn for ethanol or whatever it is. When they try to save the environment, they screw stuff up. And so I'm not comfortable going to my congressman saying, hey, do this, when it's like half the time when they do something, they screw it up because they're looking out for their own interests somehow.
Right.
And it messes everything up. Now, yeah, hands up.
Well, and that's just it. It's a lot of times they're not screwing it up. What's happening is they're getting lobbied by other people, their support from other quarters, and so, oh, well, gee, you know, these, we need to do something for these corn farmers, let's go the ethanol route, and then we're creating biofuels out of corn, which is totally inefficient and takes more energy to produce than it does for you to be able to burn later. But it benefits, again, that farm sector. So it's not that they screwed up. They kind of intentionally made some of these choices.
Yeah, they intentionally screwed up. Yeah.
That's what politics is about.
Yeah, yeah.
Intentionally screwed up.
Let me some more voices come in here. Yeah.
Well, the basic problem, whether it is capitalism, whether it's communism, whether it doesn't matter. The basic problem is greed. Mm-hmm. That's the crux of the problem. And in the Midwest, we have farmers who used to pasture their cows who are now in this feedlot that stinks to high heaven so that we have Wisconsin derriere and Huntington. And they know that this isn't good. These cows are not happy. This is not good for the cows.
Sir, I'm sorry. I just want to let lots of people get voices heard before we...
One thing, I think everybody, whether you're a Christian or not, has a problem with capitalism, I think is a basic premise of growth. We're in a finite planet. And the way that I see capitalism, at least in this country, is that it relies on this continual growth. We constantly have to grow. But it's not sustainable. We need something else.
So, if I could just interject, I saw your hand first. If I could just interject, how are we going to move forward? I mean, this is a wonderful discussion that is a great way to start. But looking backwards is different than stepping forward. So can we try and focus the next, 10 minutes on looking forward? What changes are you personally willing to step forward for or lobby for, or if you're not going to lobby, change in other ways? You had your hand up.
Yeah, I'm reading the Shock Doctrine by Naomi Klein right now, I'm very critical of capitalism, let's put it that way. And particularly Friedman's Chicago School and the neoliberal model. I haven't read a book in a while that's made me feel more hopeless and more... I don't know if you guys are familiar with the book, but it seems like what's been particularly disheartening to me is like the chapter on South Africa, where these radical changes could have taken place and it was all undone in the snap of a finger, in the blink of an eye. And it just seems like it's getting worse and worse, and certainly the last 10 years it's gotten worse and worse globally. So my question is, how do we take apart Walter Wink, throwing at all these different people, but that the powers have fallen, the powers have to be redeemed. How on earth do we redeem this? I know that's what you're asking for discussion, but I don't even know where to begin with this now.
Well, it's a little, we've talked about some of these things over the course of the week, and I recognize that most of you haven't been there. But one of the things that I think is, I as a Christian believe, we have an imperative to do is be one of the voices of hope. I've been talking about environmental things in front of various faith groups for at least 5 years. 5 years ago, all the discussion was about denial. We don't really have a problem. Now, most of the discussion is about despair. We've jumped from denial to despair. We forgot the action piece, right? And so one of the things that I try and push people on is we are a people that's used to hope, that believes in grace. So, what are we willing to do as a community of faith to enable that? And your hand was up first.
Okay, so
about politics, politics is really a negotiation of power. That's what politics is about. How do you manipulate and negotiate power? And when I look up on your lovely diagram there, I'm reminded of social energy. And maybe I made the speech before, but it seems to me that there needs to be conceptual clarity when we talk about what should Christians do. You know, are we asking, what should I do? I'm a Christian. What should my congregation do? We're Christians together. What should my denomination do? What should theologians do? All of those fall into something like the pronoun we,
mm-hmm.
right?
They sure
but
do.
We need to sometimes be really clear about which scale and which sort of Christianity we're talking about when we try to utilize that social energy that we have as Christians. Just having, as an individual Christian, a horizon that allows for hope gives energy, just for one person. And it may be the kind of energy that allows us to work on policy, but not everyone has the fortitude for it. Some people need to work on civil society and thinking about things like the way in which our obsession about doing things quickly mm-hmm. contributes to our use of energy and our abuse of other people. Right? So every time I get in an airplane, I think, isn't it interesting that the things that we have done to try and go faster are suggesting that the time horizon is getting shorter and shorter. So I would say that one of the really important things Christians do is, of course, talk about hope, but also to begin to reconsider what we care about most in the world. Do we care more about doing things fast or about a longer horizon of time and other people?
And if we live in a world, this social world, that really seems to care about doing things fast, is our responsibility to create separate spaces that aren't that fast or to try and change that society?
But I would say, you know, I don't think you should ask it that as an either or question. I think that's the point, is that the answer is both.
Okay. Christian.
I want to live in the world as I imagine it should be, taking off on what Alan Story was talking about in terms of the real world, what God, in a sense, envisions creation should be. So, for example, for a long time I've been a bike commuter, and I drive past car after car after car that pass me and get up to the red light, and I catch up with them, and then they pass me and go to the next red light, and I catch up with them. And that, just riding day after day, is a simple way I can tell myself, okay, I'm going to live differently now. I'm not going to wait, personally. So that's an individual level Christian response. But then we drove from Connecticut to Washington to get here, and we saw probably every means of energy production that our nation has right now, from solar to wind to enormous long trains of coal in Wyoming and all the oil wells. And
trains of corn going the other way.
Yeah. And I thought to myself, why is it that coal is cheap and wind power is expensive? When, if we think about the long-term costs associated with the two of them, wind power we should be subsidizing so it's cheap, and we should be taxing coal so it's expensive. So on the policy level, I would like Christian congregations and the church as a whole to be public advocates for changing our priorities around how we subsidize different kinds of energy production.
Yeah, I'll give you one of the reasons I pitched Earth Ministry. Is Earth Ministry was very involved in Washington State last year, lobbying to get Washington State to join this Western States Climate Initiative working toward a carbon tax.
Yeah.
Right, so, I personally, sat and with Washington State senators and legislators and said, the faith community wants a carbon tax.
Yeah.
And so the question, that's kind of a small step, right? But the question is, are we willing to take steps?
Yeah.
And I, there's no, one thing that those of you who kind of followed some of this week,
there's no right or wrong answers here. You know, this is a process. Some of us...
There might be some wrong answers.
But there's grains of truth in everything. I mean, there is absolutely no doubt that the capitalistic system has been wonderfully productive in many sectors. I think there's some question in my there's some question in my mind is whether that time is over, whether we're moving to a new era. You've had your hand up for a long time, so we'll give you the last word. But two last words. One of the things that we still haven't said, we haven't even talked about yet, is how are we going to feed the people who are starving to death today? How's this going to happen in the next 2 years?
Well, we're fortunate, we're here, and we're in a wilderness area where legally you're not supposed to take a motorized things out here in a village, it's like these people you were stepping, we're a minority of a minority of a minority. Okay. So what you're discussing is educational and advocacy, and it's wonderful. I think sometimes we need to even make it broader in saying that when you say we, we're not just talking about me, but I'm talking about the squirrel that's running around here and everything else. We want to be good stewards, and we want to have sustainability of our planet.
Amen.
Okay, and so that's what I'm trying to do, mm-hmm. to answer your question. How effective I am is something else.
Yeah. Okay.
I belong to the Mountaineers. Sure, I belong to the Mushroom Society. But so what? You know. Okay.
Okay.
I don't know what I'm asking your question.
No, that's it.
But that's the direction that I'm going.
Okay, we got 12 minutes till Vesper, so one last voice.
Well, I had a number of things that I wanted to mention, but I think. For me, coming to Holden Village for the first time and seeing that zebra on the table over there,
we call it the elephant in the room.
The elephant in the room as well. It was kind of shocking. I mean, here we're in the beautiful, pristine nature, and there's mine tailings that are going to pollute the earth till the end of time. I don't know what they're going to do for $230 million to contain that, but I don't care whether it's communism or capitalism, but a system that allows the earth to be raped in that way is wrong, period. And I think W.E.B. Du Bois talked about avoiding issues that you know are problems. I have a little prayer that he said. But basically, that's what we're doing. We're just ignoring the big problems that we see because it's convenient. And whether you work for an investment bank or what, the answer is not going to be solved other than by the people solving the problems in the ways that we all know we have to. We can't mine the earth in the way we're doing. We can't treat each other the way that we're continuing to do. I think that the World Council of Churches needs to say enough of war. I think the Church Council of Greater Seattle or wherever you're from needs to say we can't participate in this. As Christians, it's clear the Bible says thou shalt not kill. And there's some really basic things, and we're kind of obfuscating all that with talk about 401ks, or I don't even know all the investment terms that you are using, but and sorry to pick on you, but just as an example, I think it's really obvious what needs to happen. And the people just need to rise up. And I think what we need to do is let the people know what options there are. 15 years ago, I was part of a group called Don't Waste Connecticut. We had David Brower and Michio Kaku come give a lecture on nuclear power, nuclear waste, and the answers were there back then, and they're still here. The answer to energy problems mostly is going to be reducing use and going with alternative energies. And just a couple more points. Right now, Germany is the leader in alternative energy. Within the next couple of years, Spain will be the leader. And why can't the U.S. be the leader?
Yeah.
That's kind of how I'd like to just end.
And that. Since most of us in the room are U.S. citizens, I think we need to hear that as a question we're all being asked. Why aren't we leading? And if we're not, how are we going to start? And I think that's the question we wanted to ask this week. Thanks so much for being here, and let's make sure we're not waiting.